Solomon begins with a circularity of nature, endless, laborious repetition of the same cycle appearing to go nowhere. And to view the heavens will tell you that there is a God and that He's powerful and that He is wise. And if you look into your own heart and recognize your own moral nature, you will recognize that God is righteous. That is to say, He is a God who has expectations, even as we do, of our own behavior and that of others, and that we are capable of moral choices and decisions, but we are not given any answers to the question of what right is and how we ought to live our lives and what our destiny is. And that's what Solomon had in mind, I think, when he said that God has put eternity or the world in our hearts. We have the questions. We do not have the answer by our own unaided wisdom. So he set out in this world of jarring contradictions, things crooked that cannot be made straight and things missing that cannot be numbered, and tried by his own wisely constructed experimentation to find something that life was about, ultimately. He's not looking to find something that'll keep him happy for a week or even for 40 years. He's looking for something that is ultimately, finally, intrinsically, really meaningful. And the book of Ecclesiastes is a story of one man's search for meaning in a life that appeared to be, in a world that appeared to be, meaningless. And the first thing he attempts, beginning with verse 16 of the first chapter, is to find peace and fulfillment in wisdom. Well, he was in a position to do that because he was wiser than any other man of his age. I suppose we always can resort to the visit by the Queen of Sheba to Solomon, who went away having said, "I heard a lot about you, but the half has not been told." And the Solomon she visited was not only a wise man practically, but it's obvious that she connects his wisdom with the service of the God he reverenced. And she understood, she said, that God had put him on the throne in Israel and made him wise to rule his people. If that is the case, then it was after that that this book had to be written, if Solomon wrote it, and I believe that he did. And that his testimony is powerful because he did write it. He had experienced all this. But he says, "I communed with my own heart, saying, Lo, I have gotten me great wisdom above all that were before me in Jerusalem. Yes, my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge, and I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly, and I perceived that this also was a striving after wind." He was feasting on the wind, he said. So this is not the diary of Solomon as he writes what he was thinking at the moment. This is his conclusion. He's looking back on an experiment made before, a failed experiment. Now there is about it, I think, a sense of ego. I commune with my heart that I have gotten me great wisdom. Actually, he didn't get it, did he? He was given that wisdom. And my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. He seems to be a bit infatuated and maybe just a little intoxicated with his knowledge. Maybe a visit from the Queen of Sheba praising and adoring his immense insight didn't help him become humble. It was the loss of his humility and his vulnerability and seduction by these foreign women that destroyed him, not his intellect. It was not an intellectual defection. And that's why I spoke with great concern to all of us that we remember that we can know a lot and still be absolutely destroyed by the devil, because our emotions will take us where our intellect will tell us all the time, this is the wrong way. and feelings get to us, and we have to be careful. But having applied his heart to know wisdom, he said, having finished that experiment, I found out I knew nothing. I was eating the wind. No product from this, no answer from this. Wisdom is not, first of all, the thing that will give you, that is man's unaided wisdom. It's not the thing that will give you the answer to life's ultimate questions, and it's not the thing that will give you peace and satisfaction. In a book by Buttrick on Christ and Man's Dilemma, he gave a very, I think, concise definition of our problem. He says we're ignorant, and we know we're ignorant, but we can't find the truth. We're sinful, and we know we're sinful, but we can't find purity. We are mortal, and we know we're mortal, but we can't secure life. And that's the agony that God has given us to wrestle with, hoping that somehow, out of it, we'll find the humility of heart to recognize him and to look up. But that's the truth. John F. Kennedy once made this statement. He said that human problems created by men can be solved by men. That is not true. We have created a lot of problems to which we have no solution. And I principally have in mind the sin of our lives, the prideful rebellion, the self-seeking, the complete fascination with our own interest, the unwillingness to look up and consider God, to have any kind of reverential spirit toward the origin of all that we are and ever will hope to be. And because we have sinned does not mean that we can correct that. And so here we are, philosophizing down here in this world. Philosophy has as its purpose the effort by investigation to know God. I was amused and dismayed by a little book written by Stephen Hawking, I believe, who is a very brilliant astrophysicist, a British astrophysicist, and he wrote this little book, A Short History of Time, I believe it's called. If that's not exactly accurate, I have all kinds of senior moments. I don't even get dismayed by it anymore. It happens so frequently. But he said at the end, and here he is. He is totally debilitated by ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, confined to an electric wheelchair with virtually no movement of his body. And he says in the conclusion of his book that by means of this research that we're engaged in, the hope is that we will be able to think the thoughts of God. All I can say is that that is arrogant. How would you think the thoughts of God? That brilliant little man does not have within his head even an infinitesimally small part of what resides in the mind of God. And he thinks that we have the capability to reach through our research into the very intricacies of the universe, and not just how the universe is constructed, but that we will be able to probe the very mind of God in the process. We will not do it. It is not by our investigation or by our research that we're going to be able to find the mind of God. And the truth is that it's available freely. Research will fail, investigation will fail, human ingenuity will fail. And I'll tell you why I think that is true, because we don't have the mind for it. But secondly, because God knows that if we ever found out anything that we thought was important about the universe, we'd all strut around like peacocks thinking we're the hero of this thing. It would just explode our egos. And that's the truth. We want to be the hero. That's the story of humanism. We want to be the measure of everything. And Solomon said, you can try it if you will, but you're going to find out at last that it is emptiness. There are a lot of interesting things that have been written on this subject. Men who have tried mightily to find out what the world is all about. Julian Huxley once wrote these words, 1953, "Nowhere in all its vast extent is there any trace of purpose or even of perspective significance. It is impelled from behind by blind physical forces, a gigantic and chaotic jazz dance of particles and radiation, in which the only overall tendency we have so far been able to detect is that summarized in the second law of thermodynamics, the tendency to run down." I mean, that's hopeless. Bertrand Russell, "Why should you suppose I think it foolish to wish to see the people one is fond of? What else is there to make life tolerable? We stand on the shore of an ocean crying to the night and the emptiness. Sometimes a voice answers out of the darkness, but it is the voice of one drowning, and in a moment the silence returns." And so, despair. George Bernard Shaw, from whom we quoted a passage about the Sermon on the Mount, "The science to which I pin my faith is bankrupt. Its councils, which should have established the millennium, have led directly to the suicide of Europe. I believed them once. In their name I helped to destroy the faith of millions of worshippers in the temples of 1,000 creeds, and now they look at me and witness the great tragedy of an atheist who has lost his faith." The emptiness at last that comes because men try to pierce the universe and to know the mind of God is evident. Sometimes people who do this come to another conclusion. Rabbi Harold Kushner, who wrote a book, "Why, When Bad Things Happen to Good People," he didn't title it "Why." He said, "When." "Life is not fair." And this reminds us so much of Ecclesiastes, except in its conclusion. "The wrong people get sick, and the wrong people get robbed, and the wrong people get killed in wars and in accidents, and some people see life's unfairness and decide there is no God. The world is nothing but chaos. And even when he lets you down and disappoints you by permitting bad luck and sickness and cruelty in his world and permitting some of those things to happen to you, can you learn..." Now here's where he runs off the track. "Can you learn to love and forgive him despite his limitations?" The only conclusion that Kushner could come to was that God was not all-powerful. And that's the reason these things are happening. That is not Solomon's conclusion. And Solomon tells us that in this world, the righteous get the reward of the wicked, and the wicked get the reward of the righteous. And that's so sometimes. Not always true, but it's true. And he is plain in his declaration that things don't come out right here. And if you witness all these things and try by your wisdom to penetrate the mystery and know exactly why that happens, you're going to fail. You're going to fail even if you are a devout Christian. Now, there are a lot of strains running through Ecclesiastes, trying to find something that's worth everything. And I think Solomon tells us what is worth everything. What we can do to make everything come out right transcendently, beyond this life into eternity. But he also tells us that it won't make any difference how we live and how much God may tell us, that there are going to be things we will not be able to rationalize. We're not going to be able to explain why these things happen. And he says again and again, and this starts out in the beginning of the book and runs all the way to the conclusion, "Fear God. Those that fear God will come forth from them all. He is not despondent." He tells you the truth about the world. But he has looked above the sun and he has said to us, look, the answer to the human problem is to fear God. We are not led to the explanation, which is where we'd like to be led. "I want to know, Lord, why my child was born like this. I want to know, Lord, why my loved one was struck by this automobile, no fault on his or her part, and killed to break the hearts of men." I want to know why that happened. Well, Solomon says, not here. Not in this life. And as I said to you before, Job was wrestling with that same question about his own life. Why are my children all dead? And why have I lost everything I ever worked to gather together? And why have I lost my health? And why have I lost my wife, who's now telling me to curse God and die? And God didn't answer that question. Now, we got taken before, behind the scenes in the book of Job. And we see this contest between God and the devil, but I'm not quite sure that even after we've read that we know why God let Job suffer like he did. We can say he needed to grow up. Well, maybe. But he was a righteous man, and he trusted God, and in those early days of his misery, he said some wonderful things, didn't he? Though he slay me, yet will I trust him. But I have to tell you, he wasn't talking like that as things went on and the misery got deeper. He began to say, God, this is wrong. There's something I need to have an audience with you to explain to you that this is not just, this is not right. What's happening to me is not as it ought to be. And when he finally got his wish, it was a little different than maybe he had anticipated, because God started asking him a lot of hard questions he couldn't answer. And really what God said to him was, you can't judge me. You can only trust me. That I love you, and I have the power to do good, and I will do that good. And if you don't understand it, you're going to have simply to rest your questions in me. And that's where Solomon is in Ecclesiastes. Fear God. Trust him. You're not going to get the detailed answers now. See all this world, craziness happening, injustice, oppression, people that are weak. We don't see it so much here, but living in West Africa as I did, I saw some things that just absolutely dismayed me. I mean, people couldn't even know for sure that their property was secure, because some wealthy fellow could bribe a judge and that property is gone. Reminds me of Ahab and Naboth's vineyard. Jezebel, of course, the engineer. But the point of it all is, they could just take it. Tough luck. Power is power. And it happens here. Justice is not done. Unrighteousness everywhere. Wickedness everywhere. Tragedies happening that don't make sense to us. And Solomon trying to get the wisdom to penetrate it, and he says, didn't happen. Wisdom's not the answer. And I want to tell you, you've got Stanford University over here. Brilliant professors, brilliant students, and they don't know the answer to any important question. They know how to make a living, to train you to make a living. But they don't know one thing about how to train you to live life and give you a reason to make a living or anything else. Buttrick made the observation that they'd be very much, very much indignant if you went to one of these universities and told them you need the gospel of Christ to help overcome your ignorance. But that's the truth. And then he went to something else. He said, I'm going to try mirth, chapter 2. After having said, with much wisdom is much grief, and he that increases knowledge increases sorrow, because he just finds out how ignorant he is by trying to find out the answers. And more he's just overwhelmed with what he does not know and what he cannot do anything about. Now we'll try pleasure, he said. And by the way, pleasure is not sinful by definition, is it? Who made pleasurable things? In the Screwtape Letters, where Wormwood the nephew is getting advice from his uncle Screwtape on how to tempt people. And he's talking about our Father below and how he works things, and the enemy, which is of course God. And he says, you know, our Father below has tried his best to develop some new pleasure that he could use to tempt men, but he hadn't been able to get a single one. Actually, all those things come from the enemy. And what we have to do is to get them to take those pleasures and use them contrary to his will. Those pleasures are given to us by God. But what Solomon is trying to do with pleasure is to make it the absolute, ultimate end of life. You can take things that are good and turn them into God. And I can tell you, they will be feasting on the wind. They will be disastrous to you. And that's what Solomon is about here. Trying to make wisdom God. Didn't work. Now he's going to try to make pleasure God. And it won't work either. I search in my heart, verse 3, how to cheer my flesh with wine, my heart yet guiding me with wisdom, how to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the sons of men that they should do under the heaven all the days of their life. So here, pleasure is his pursuit. Now, I want to tell you something. It's not just going out and getting drunk he's talking about here. I don't know that this wine is anything more than excellent food, which is what wine sometimes was in the Scripture. Children drank it. It was not an intoxicant or a drug. Mentioned in connection with food. And some of us think, this is a good life. I like to have the good food and go to the good restaurants and go see the wonderful places and live that wonderful life, this full life in which I am made very aware of all life's exquisite things. You don't do anything immoral. But that's your God. And it'll kill you. Good music. All those things are innocent in the right approach. But when they are taken as what life is about, then they destroy us. And certainly they destroy us when we take those things that God has given us and use them contrary to His will and turn them into poison. But maybe that's not your temptation. And maybe it is. But Solomon then turned to enterprise. This is honorable. You know, working, building, creating something. I said that this section about pleasures and palaces. It's about building wonderful houses. It's about building wonderful gardens. If you've ever been to some of the palaces in the world and seen the gardens that are in the grounds about them, wonderfully constructed, lovely to look at, enjoyable to be there, the flowers so luxuriant, so well kept. And Solomon did that, and he had the money to do it. And he says that when he got through, he really felt good about it until he began to ask, what does it all mean? I know you think you own your house, but you don't. You're a renter. Ah, no, you say, I have got the papers. Not only, I'm not even in partnership with the bank anymore. I own this thing outright. You don't own it. And if you didn't build it in the first place, you're not the first owner. He's dead, maybe, or moved off somewhere else. But the point of it all is, you don't own it. And Solomon stresses that fact as he goes through thinking about wealth and things that they bring. And he's grieved because of what happens. He says in verse 18 of the second chapter, and I hated all my labor when I labored under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man that shall be after me, and who knows whether you'll be a wise man or a fool. I do all this work, and some fool inherits it, doesn't have any appreciation whatsoever for it, and lets it all go to smash. And that's not the only thing that is troubling here for Solomon. Chapter 5, verse 13, there is a grievous evil. There is a grievous evil which I have seen under the sun, namely riches kept by the owner thereof to his hurt, and those riches perished by evil adventure. He's piled up all these funds, and he's feeling good about himself. Soul, take thine ease. You have much goods laid up for many years, and suddenly the stock market crashes, or the thing he's invested in goes sour. And it's all over. And his son has nothing. Can that happen? It happens. And not because somebody's been dishonest, or not because somebody's been imprudent. He does the best he can, and yet it can be taken away from him. And you can do the best you can in this life, and you think sitting in this country that there's no possibility that all of us could be wiped out, but there's every kind of possibility that could happen. And if everybody doesn't get wiped out, you can still get wiped out. So what's all this about, he says. And then he tells us the way it is, and this is repeated in the New Testament by the Apostle Paul. He came forth from his mother's womb naked, and naked shall he go again as he came, and he shall take nothing for his labor, which he may carry away in his hand. And this also is a grievous evil, that in all points as he came, so shall he go, and what profit is he that labors for the wind? That's the truth. You can't keep it. You won't take anything with you. We've said it over and over again, but we don't believe it. We're agnostic about that. We say it, but we don't believe it. We know we're going to die, but we don't believe it. I say we don't believe it because we do not take it into account in the decisions that we make and how we invest our lives. And then he goes on to say some other things about this. Verse 18, "Behold, that which I have seen to be good and to be comely is for one to eat and to drink and enjoy good in all his labor when he labors under the sun." That takes us to another subject, which we'll take up later. But he speaks about another man who gets all of his money together, and then he can't enjoy it when he gets it. I'm telling you, it's a bad thing to get all that money. You can buy anything to eat you want, and the doctor tells you you can't eat it. They kill you. No more gravy. That's hard. No more fried foods. He's got all this money and nothing. Reminds me of the famous California billionaire living as a recluse. Miserable. Time and chance happen to all men. You can't be secure in this life by your own wisdom and sagacity. You cannot be secure in this life by pleasure, absolutely. And we'll be told before this book is over that the time's going to come when you will have no pleasure in them. And you're not going to get it by building things, all of which may be good within themselves, within the right perspective, but have no ultimate significance. They cannot be a foundation for your life. And insofar as we look at them as that, insofar as we identify our souls with them as that, then we are going to lose everything. Everything. Totally miserable. Well, with regard to wisdom, you remember what Solomon said at the end of the book, and this does not have reference to doing homework, young people. He said, "Of the making of many books, there is no end, and much study is the weariness of the flesh." What he's talking about is that philosophers have been writing on what life is about for centuries and centuries and centuries, and they still haven't gotten it. And that's the reason the books keep pouring off the press. They're still reaching for it and cannot get it. And that's human philosophy. It has been an abject failure from the beginning. We cannot know the mind of God. Wisdom will not reach up and get the answer to all the troublesome questions and the heartbreaking questions we have about life. And so that kind of enterprise is bound to fail. So the answer, Solomon says, in his quest to all his effort to find satisfaction and peace in these things, is that it was emptiness and futility. Now, in the midst of this second chapter, he says, what can they do who come after the king? I mean, you say, well, he failed, but I won't fail. What makes you optimistic? You are wiser than Solomon? You are more wealthy than Solomon, who made silver like rocks in Jerusalem? Gold aplenty? Riches, so forth? Let me add one other thing here that I think is suggested, and then we'll close. And here's relationships sometimes become our God. You remember how many wives and concubines Solomon had? 700 wives, 300 concubines. I don't see any way he even visited all of them before he died. 700 wives, 300 concubines, and in the midst of his discussion of his treasures, he says in verse 8, "I gathered me also silver and gold and the treasures of kings and of the provinces. I got me men singers and women singers and the delights of the sons of men." Other translation says that he's talking about concubines. And I think there's good cause to think that. How did Solomon come out with women? Look at the 7th chapter, verse 26. "And I find more bitter than death the woman whose heart is snares and nets and whose hands are bands. Whoso pleases God shall escape from her, but the sinner shall be taken by her." He ought to know. "Behold, this I have found, says the preacher, laying one thing to another to find out the account which my soul still seeks. But I have not found. One man among a thousand have I found, but a woman among all these have I not found." Now, that might be a consequence of what he tried to do. He made women his God. I want to tell you something. You can't even make your own wife your God. Or your husband your God. You can't make that the quintessential basis of your life. There's a book written called A Severe Mercy by Sheldon Van Auken. He and his wife made a covenant when they married that no one should be more important than the other to them. That in this relationship, no one else or no thing else should ever invade. And then one day, his wife, Davy, came home and talked to him about God. He said, "I was greatly displeased. This was a violation of the covenant." And she continued to talk to him about God and drew him into it until finally he was willing, he said, to accept Davy and God. He put that "and God" out there. And then Davy became sick with cancer. Thus the title of the book, A Severe Mercy. And through those days, he said, he came to understand that it was not Davy and God. It was God and Davy. We thank God today that relationships we have in Christ are untouched by death and intensified in eternity. All the joys that we have in the Lord here are bound to be inexpressibly wonderful. And all the relationships we have here, inexpressibly wonderful, in the life that is to come, I don't know how He'll work it out. But I trust it, which is what we all must do, in the face of these great perplexities, give up trying to find anything under the sun that's worth it all. And lift your hearts above to see the face of the loving, righteous, all-powerful God, who will make, as we have sung, all things beautiful in His time. Thank you.